From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, KCPW's Ryan Cunningham has a conversation with Dana Allison, founder and executive director of the Utah-based Women's World Health Initiative, which is engaged in grassroots efforts to reduce maternal and infant mortality in developing countries.
There are so many issues facing people who find themselves in vulnerable populations, starvation, poverty of all kinds, violence. But the one thing that I continually found to be the most devastating was when a mother died during childbirth, often due to preventable causes.
That conversation, your top local headlines, and more just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. First up, though, this world news from the BBC. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up a little bit later on the show, a conversation about a Utah group's efforts to prevent infant mortality in Senegal. But first up, we have these headlines. Utah authorities say a 6-year-old boy found chained to a bed while his father was at work probably was shackled like that each of the past 10 days since school ended. Logan City Police Chief Gary Jensen says they believe the boy's father chained him to the bedpost each day when he left for work, unchaining him when he got home. Jensen says the boy had some water and snacks and just enough slack to reach the bathroom. The 28-year-old father was booked into Cache County Jail on 4 counts of child abuse. The Associated Press is not naming the man to avoid identifying the child. The boy has been placed in custody of State Child Protective Services. Police are investigating whether the man's live-in girlfriend knew about what was going on. The Utah Department of Human Services offers resources for those involved in domestic violence and abuse. The confidential 24-hour child abuse and neglect hotline is 1-800-323-DCFS. The founder of a Mormon women's group pushing for gender equality says that the church is trying to excommunicate her. Kate Kelly says she received a letter this week from the bishop of her Virginia congregation informing her of a disciplinary hearing set for June 22nd. In the letter posted on her blog, the bishop says leaders are considering ousting her because of apostasy, defined as repeated and public advocacy of positions that oppose church teachings. Kelly says that she's shocked and devastated. She's led demonstrations at the past 2 conferences of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, objecting to women being barred from the all-male meeting. Church leaders asked her group to stay off Temple Square in April, but she held the demonstration there anyway. Church officials didn't immediately have comment. The Healthy Utah Plan, Governor Gary Herbert's alternative to federal Medicaid expansion, is getting a boost from the Salt Lake County Council. On Tuesday, the council unanimously agreed to send a letter asking state legislative leaders to call a special session of lawmakers this summer to address the governor's proposal. Democratic Councilman Sam Granato wrote the draft of the letter for the council's review. That letter ended up receiving bipartisan support.
It's not just one side of the aisle. It is 4 Democrats and 5 Republicans have come together to, if you will, plead with the legislature leadership to look at the plan that Governor Herbert has put in place, call a special session, and let's get down to the business of taking care of the citizens.
Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams has also been pushing for the legislature to act. He says that without some expansion, there could be dire consequences for the county's mental health service providers in particular.
Salt Lake County is looking at significant cuts to the services we provide in behavioral and mental health substance abuse programs that we will not be able to continue after January 1st, 2015 if the state does not take action on the governor's Healthy Utah Plan. Those are real people who have substance abuse problems. They have children and families that we're trying to get them healthy and back as integral members of our community. And if those programs are cut off, we're going to see 3,200 people who will no longer receive behavioral and mental health and substance abuse treatment programs.
A recent Brigham Young University poll shows that more than 3/4 of Utahns support Medicaid expansion that is at least as encompassing as the governor's plan. Herbert negotiated a federal block grant program as an alternative to the full expansion envisioned under the Affordable Care Act. The governor's plan would cover about 110,000 low-income Utahns. Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill also spoke in favor of the legislature acting on this issue soon. Gill says that not addressing the problem of Utah's low-income uninsured will have specific and negative effects on the criminal justice system.
But it also has a direct impact on the jail population. We know that, for example, almost 90% of the inmates nationally have no health insurance. We know that they have a high incidence of mental health issues and physical health needs. They would actually find relief because when they leave the jail, they would actually have medical coverage, thereby having insurance to be able to address their underlying mental health and physical health and substance abuse treatment options. And we also know that if this population, this jail population, which gets to that 133% of poverty, that these populations greatly impacted in terms of the recidivism rate.
In May, Utah House Speaker Becky Lockhart said that it was unlikely that the House would support the governor's plan in a special session. KCPW was unable to reach Speaker Lockhart or Senate President Wayne Niederhauser for comment on Wednesday. One of southern Utah's signature towering arches could soon be closed to daredevil rope swinging. Federal officials are considering a ban on the stunt that has frustrated visitors marveling at Corona Arch. The sport involves taking a running leap and swinging like a pendulum through a five-story sandstone structure. The activity was made so popular on YouTube that state authorities banned it from commercial outfitters last year. Many hikers say they signed up to take in the natural wonder, not an extreme sports arena filled with daredevil howls. The Federal Bureau of Land Management took ownership of the arch last month in a land swap with the state. Rock Smith of the Moab BLM office says officials have begun surveying the area, the first step in imposing new rules. And that does it for a summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. This is The Rundown. We'll be right back. Now on the program, we turn to a conversation between KCPW reporter Ryan Cunningham and Dana Allison, founder and executive director of the Women's World Health Initiative, which is based here in Utah and works on improving health conditions in the developing world. The group is especially active in trying to reduce maternal and infant mortality rates in Senegal. Ryan spoke with Dana Allison of the Women's World Health Initiative via Skype earlier today.
So Dana, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And where are you calling from today on Skype?
I'm currently in Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas, that's where you live now?
Yes, it is.
Where are you from?
I was born and raised in Canada and have moved all over the world really throughout my life.
Which part of Canada?
I was raised in Alberta, the province of Alberta, in the middle of nowhere.
That's kind of how I picture Alberta, actually.
Yeah, that is pretty much the picture of Alberta, except for a few spots of population.
But you got out. Where'd you go to school?
I went to the University of Chicago. I studied political science and public policy. I did a double major there. From there, I did multiple things. One of them was living in Taiwan and studied Mandarin for a while. I did research in Toronto, Canada, which led me to actually my first trip to Africa when I saw the state of international health care in a developing country. And then I landed in Salt Lake City.
Okay. And what brought you to Salt Lake City then?
I attended the University of Utah Medical School.
So that's where you formed this group, the Women's World Health Initiative, right?
That's correct. So while I was in medical school, I spent some time interning with the United Nations High Commission of Refugees in Thailand in a refugee camp. And it was there that I really formulated the plan for Women's World Health Initiative, although obviously it's evolved over the years. But there's so many issues facing people who find themselves in vulnerable populations, starvation, poverty of all kinds, violence, not being safe, those kinds of things. But the one thing that I continually saw day to day and found to be the most devastating was when a mother died during childbirth because of, and often due to preventable causes. Because when a mother dies, so does most of the, not only her family, but also her community, and either economically or socially. So that's when I really learned that if we keep a mother alive and well in her home, many of these issues that we see worldwide can be mitigated or even helped in ways that we couldn't do with any other prevention measures.
So what are some of the programs or ideas that your group has come up with to make sure that the mother is there?
We started to look at maternal mortality and what its causes were and why it was happening. And there are some simple interventions in some ways that can improve outcomes for mothers, especially in very vulnerable populations. 99% of all maternal deaths are found in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia, for instance. So that is one of the reasons why we focused in Africa. We're based in Senegal, West Africa, in a place that sees many mothers die every year due to these preventable causes.
It's a specific part of Senegal, right?
Yeah, so we work within the most removed area in Senegal, away from the city, because in urban populations, although problems certainly exist there, the access to any sort of health care of any kind is extremely difficult in the area that we work, which is in rural areas. And we're actually on the border of Mali and Guinea, which has its own issues with border movement and safety issues, etc. So the problem for these people is heightened. And so we thought that we wanted to work within the most vulnerable populations.
I read on your website that there is this problem with men allowing women to go to the hospital for childbirth. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so they're generally not involved in that. And the problem with separating the pregnancy and childbirth as by gender, and certainly the mother carries the baby, but we see in our own culture that men are very involved or try to be involved as support systems, certainly, you know, driving their wives to the hospital when she goes in labor and those kinds of things. But men in this society don't really have that role at all, and in fact find themselves without a partnership in childbirth at all. So one of the things that the women's group in the area did was to encourage men to be involved, because of course when men aren't involved, they are the monetary decision makers. Even if the woman's making the money, she can't choose to use her limited resources on her own health care. And so she often doesn't get any sort of health care of any kind throughout her pregnancy or postpartum, and certainly not during delivery. So the women in the area decided that this was no longer going to be the case as they learned about the privilege of living through a childbirth, although we don't see it as a privilege, they certainly did. And so they started to encourage men to take their wives to the healthcare clinic when she was laboring, so that, because having your birth attended to by a skilled attendant improves the outcomes tenfold. So if the husband did not take the wife to the hospital when she delivered, the women would join together and go to the home of the husband and wife to, some would say, shame him, but to remind him that this is an important thing that he should do. He should support his wife and get her to a place where she'll be safe delivering her baby. So we see these kinds of women's movements as they learn more about their rights during childbirth.
Are there certain stigmas that not only women face, but men also face when it comes to childbirth in Senegal?
I don't think stigma is the right word. It's more a socialized gender movement about who participates in birth and who's responsible for it. You know, there's this very difficult situation that when a mother dies during childbirth or for any other reason, those children are really considered orphans, even though they have a father present. So the children would be distributed between other family members where a woman is, an auntie or a grandma. And we don't see that in our society because although we do have some traditional gender roles in our country, men are still considered active participants in the raising of their children. And there they don't have that, which causes problems when the mother is no longer present, the kinds of problems we already spoke about.
So it sounds like it's important to have people on the ground there doing the work there. Are there things that people are doing stateside to support the program? People in Salt Lake City, for instance, what are people doing here?
Yes, certainly. In fact, Dopplers were provided to Women's World Health Initiative, which Dopplers are fetal heart monitors that audibly through a small handheld speaker, and it's run by a battery, so it's very accessible to the midwives in the area in Senegal to use and to easily use. Those were donated to us, and one of the great things that which we didn't anticipate initially, but certainly happened, was that the midwife could provide the use of the Doppler to the pregnant women, which they had never seen anything like this before, and certainly not heard their baby's heart tone while it was still a fetus. And one of the social outcomes, which was unexpected, that we saw was that once the village heard that there was this machine, so to speak, that they could hear their baby's heart tone while the baby was still in the mother's stomach, we actually saw the husbands start to attend with their wives. Because they then could become a participant in a way that they never thought before, and that they could too hear their baby's heart tone, and that their interest turned into actually a social partnership, the very problem I was just speaking about. So there certainly are outcomes and assistance that has helped. Obviously, the kinds of things that are most helpful are investment into the actual people. So we have only one paid staff member in all the United States. And so any donations that come to us really get put to the program and to the people and investment in the country in Senegal.
How do you measure your success as a nonprofit working in this field?
Yeah, we try to have a rigorous data assessment, both for efficacy as well as outcomes for the pregnant women. Our whole intent is to utilize the existing healthcare system that is in the area and to really buff up what they're already doing, because obviously if you completely try to change the structure, it will be foreign to them, and they, once you leave, will not continue those processes. So the community health workers and the midwives actively provide data about the people that they've newly monitored, the women that they have taken care of, the births that are now attended because of information provided or acknowledgement of a working healthcare system in that woman's area, those kinds of things. So we have quarterly reports of the improvements and certain measurements related to pregnancy and health outcomes for the women in the area.
So it's interesting to me, as a med student, you saw this problem, you were concerned about it, so you started this group and you've come this far. What kind of person takes up an international cause like this, and what does it take for a person to take up a cause like this?
I mean, my first intuition is a crazy one. I'm not sure if that's the answer that you're looking for. It's certainly a very difficult venture, much more so than I could have anticipated. But this organization has been extremely fortunate with supportive donors, most importantly, supportive volunteer systems, and a really good board of directors that exists throughout Canada, the United States, and has grown exponentially, certainly in its reach. There's always more to do. We're testing our theories that the way that we approach philanthropy is the right way, the most sustainable way. And I certainly have not done this alone, even though I'm the founder. I have been continually supported by people who have done far more than I could have ever produced myself.
Dana, I want to thank you so much for taking the time today to speak to me. And enjoy the very hot weather in Austin. I'm sure it's about 110 degrees over there.
Yes, it's not quite that hot, but it is certainly warmer than most places.
Thank you, Dana.
Thank you very much.
And again, that was Dana Allison, founder and executive director of the Women's World Health Initiative, in conversation with KCPW reporter Ryan Cunningham. You can find this conversation as well as all of our past interviews at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're tuned into The Rundown. We'll be right back. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show is produced by Lauren Colucci, with additional help from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Tyler Ford. Our theme music is composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, tune in for a conversation about the new carbon emissions rules from the EPA and their effect in the state of Utah. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.